I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another weekly live stream. And my guest in the first hour is lawyer Rich Hauck. We are going to be talking about what happens if Roe versus Wade is indeed overturned in the United States. We're going to talk about the legal reasoning of Roe versus Wade, what's going on with this new Supreme Court ruling that's been leaked, and some of the consequences that we can look forward to, and whether or not this is going to be good for white people. If you would like to send a question or a comment, and you want it to be fast-tracked, if you want it to be noticed, please send it with a donation, and you can do that through Entropy, entropystream.live/countercurrents. That's on the bottom of the screen, and we will definitely take a look at that, and we will get to your comments and questions during the course of the stream. If you have questions specifically for Rich on this issue, please get them in soon. The second half of today's stream will be an Ask Me Anything, and you can ask me anything, and I will save questions that are off topic, off the Roe versus Wade topic, to the latter hour of the stream and just deal with them there. You can also send us Odyssey tips if Odyssey is actually working. You can use your credit card to send a tip through Odyssey, and we would very much appreciate that. So, Rich, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. How you guys doing?
So, it was leaked at the beginning of last week that the Supreme Court is perhaps going to overturn Roe versus Wade. What happened is a draft decision, not a final decision of the court, but a draft decision of the court representing the views of five justices, a majority, for overturning Roe versus Wade, was leaked to the press. People went mad. Many people on the left, many pro-abortion people went absolutely mad with fear. And many people on the right, pro-lifers, were elated. I had mixed feelings about this because it's not the most important issue for me. Anyway, if indeed this leak is correct and there is no change in the decision, these justices aren't pressured or in some way to change their views, which would basically make a farce out of the Supreme Court. At this point, you might as well just torch the whole Constitution and start from scratch if these people can be so easily swayed by public opinion. If this does go through, there will be major changes in America, in American law. How big those changes are is an open question. So we're going to explore all of that. And to begin with, though, I would like you to give me some of your lawyer's background on what the reasoning of the Roe versus Wade decision is. A lot of people don't really know what kind of argument was actually made that legalized abortion nationwide back in 1973. So can you give us just an overview of Roe?
It's kind of an interesting string of cases and how we got there. And there's a couple things that make sense. And then you have a couple kind of jumps that are like quantum leaps in logic that you think, okay, I'm tracking. Whoa, how did we get to this? Going back till I think really the late 1800s, you started seeing in Supreme Court opinions and like circuit court opinions, you see like Learnhand using this. He's a famous judge. This idea of a penumbra within the Constitution and rights. And what a penumbra is sort of, I imagine it, there's different interpretations and explanations. I imagine it is like a shadow of something. And the shadow of something is in a way part of the thing itself. So it's like if you have a tree or a house and you have some shade from it, you know, that shade, the shadowy area, doesn't just exist in a vacuum. It exists because the house or the tree or whatever there is blocking the sun and casting a shadow, right? So what these different judges and legal scholars started to sort of discuss and wrestle with is this idea that the rights that we have in the Constitution kind of cast this shadow. And in that shadow, there are some other things found. And one of those things that they talk about that you hear famously about the penumbra is the right to privacy. And what the initial argument goes that if you look at, I think the first, third, fourth, fifth, and ninth amendments, that when you take these things holistically, so you have the First Amendment saying, hey, You have the right to speak, but also not to speak. You have a right to not have troops quartered in your home. You have a right from unreasonable search and seizures. You have a right to not self-incriminate yourself. And then the Ninth Amendment that says, just because we didn't enumerate a right, just because we didn't put it in there, doesn't mean you don't have it. So this idea was that the people writing the Bill of Rights, the framers, didn't want a government to say, oh, well, you don't have a right to do X, Y, Z. You know, you could just make up anything. Just imagine anything that's not in the Constitution. Let's say it's riding a horse. Hey, we didn't say you have a right to ride a horse in the Constitution. Therefore, it's illegal to ride a horse. The Ninth Amendment kind of reserves, kind of cuts that out and reserves these general rights to the people. So this idea of a right to privacy sort of came about over the years, derived from the shadow of all these other rights and taking them together. You say, hey, if I have a right to not talk to the government or not have to endorse what the government says, and I have a right to not have my home searched, and I have a right to not incriminate myself, and I have a right to not let government agents in my house or quarter troops or whatever, there's this general right to privacy. Okay, this is quite some time ago. You start seeing this argument around. And then it pops up for the first time, really important, in the Roe v. Wade chain and a case called Griswold versus Connecticut. And what that case is about is that there was this, like, a Planned Parenthood that opened up. There was a doctor named Estelle Griswold. The doctor might have been, Estelle might have been the Planned Parenthood, like, head. And then there was a doctor who was running the clinic. Anyway, they were offering contraceptives to women. And there was a law in place in Connecticut that said, trying to think of the exact law, it was basically outlawing contraceptives. It was kind of a pro-natalist policy. And, you know, of course, these people got charged with the crime that were running the Planned Parenthood. And the case goes up, ends up in the front of the Supreme Court. And they're saying, the argument being made for Griswold and Planned Parenthood is that if women have the right to privacy, what a married man and women do, you know, whether they want to use contraceptive or not. And then you kind of see this come up later in the gay marriage argument in Obergefell. So you see the same kind of, like, similar reasoning, even though that's a due process argument. They say, hey, if they have a right to privacy, the government can't really be infringing on whether or not they use contraceptive. That's sort of one of their rights. Now, and this also is a little bit circular. So it's not just the right to privacy. It's also found in this penumbra. So, of course, there's nothing about contraceptives in the Constitution, but because of the Ninth Amendment and then the cluster of arguments that they say generates this right to privacy, that it just can't be something that's within the realm of the state to be deciding for people. So that goes, says, okay, it's a pretty big decision, 7-2 in favor of striking down the law that was restrictive on contraceptive use for couples. So then you have that in the mid-60s. And then, you know, less than 10 years later, you get Roe v. Wade coming up. And that one, you have Jane Roe, who's like, it's just John Doe. So she didn't want her name to be in the court document. So it's just Jane Roe's not a real person, just a random woman who is suing Henry Wade, who was then the DA of Dallas County, Texas, about a law that said no abortions unless you have a doctor's order. Now, in this time, of course, before 1973, the issue of abortion is just left up to the states. So states decide. There's a whole patchwork of laws in each state, some being, you know, no abortion. You know, here in Dallas County, you could get an abortion under the doctor's orders. And I think it was specific, like the doctor had to say, this is an abortion to save the mother's life. Like the pregnancy is so complicated that her life is endangered by continuing the pregnancy. So the law gets challenged and again goes up to the Supreme Court, of course. And the Supreme Court finds that, similar to contraceptives, this is where now we get a big quantum leap here in the logic, that if there's a right to privacy, there's a right to private medical decisions, which include abortion. And then that was kind of it. And it's weird because the logic isn't really that deep. You don't really know where it came from. Nobody really does. I mean, it's right. Why they still debate it all these years later, you know?
Right. I mean, it seems to beg the most important question, which is abortion killing another human being or not? If it is killing another human being, then you can't really say it's private, right?
Right, right. That's a, you know, a big argument, and it's almost not even, well, it's considered. I'll get to that in a minute. So what they said, okay, yes, you have a right to an abortion, but it's not unlimited. So they do get into exactly what you're saying, and what they come up with this trimester argument. There's two important parts that, like, you know, a layman, I guess, would want to know about Roe v. Wade. One, they said, sure, you have a right to an abortion, but it's limited. And it's limited by this trimester argument. And that's the second prong. So the trimester thing goes like this. First trimester of pregnancy, the state cannot regulate the abortion. It's just up to the woman and her doctor to decide if they want to continue the pregnancy or not. In the second trimester, reasonable regulations related to maternal health may be imposed by the state. And then in the third trimester, that was argued that because in the third trimester, the fetus reaches a point of viability, the state may step in and say no abortions at this point, because now we have an interest in protecting that life. So that was the rule of the land until a later decision called Planned Parenthood versus Casey. But I think it's important to understand, if we just want to talk Roe, that they divided things up in these three trimesters. They said, first, yes, you have a right to get an abortion, but it's not unlimited, and here's how we will limit you. And then for a long time, states would make their laws, but they had to comport with this Supreme Court holding. So they could say, okay, we can't do anything about abortion in the first trimester, whatever. And then they would make some laws for the second one. So for example, they could say, you know, no abortion in the second trimester unless there's a threat of the woman dying or serious health or maybe the health of the child, things like that. And then they said, okay, if you wait till the third trimester, states have essentially free reign to ban abortion at that point, because now there's an interest in a human life separate from the mother. And a lot of the arguments we see today in the general, like, cultural milieu that are about, you know, her body, her choice, that comes the first trimester argument, where that's what the Supreme Court said. Hey, you know, it's not a viable human yet, which I don't think is a super strong argument anyway, because there are a lot of, like, cases of unviable humans. Like, if, you know, if someone's on life support and you rolled up into the hospital because it was your enemy and you pulled the plug on them and killed them, like, you can't argue, well, that they weren't viable, so therefore I didn't murder them. Like, they're still going to charge you with murder, you know what I mean? And you can make all kinds of funny hypotheticals like that, sort of disprove this argument. But then they would say, and then the second, you see, it's all about healthcare. So, okay, was the mother's life in danger? Is the child's life in danger? That sort of thing. And then you get the third trimester argument where it's, hey, this is a human life, you can't kill it. So you see from the pro-life people, they essentially argue from what the Supreme Court said in Roe about the third trimester. The pro-abortion, pro-choice people, they argue from the first part. And then you get people who are kind of in the second trimester. So it's really interesting to me that the sort of language of this debate culturally can be traced back directly to this trimester argument found in Roe v. Wade that is really pretty, it was kind of just pulled out of a hat. It doesn't have really deep roots anywhere.
Well, is the trimester idea even based in biology?
No, that's another argument, is that it's not even fully based in biology as far as when, like, life happens or viability happens. There's all kinds of arguments against that, that the viability thing is earlier or later. So people are still arguing that. I don't know who, I'd have to look at the original opinion to see if they cited any, like, doctors or studies or how they came up with that. But,
well, it just sounds like an arbitrary.
It's very arbitrary. Yes.
Yeah. Political compromise.
It is. It's a political compromise. But that was the rule, and that to kind of bring it full circle. And then I'll let you, if you want to say anything, and then we'll get to Casey real quick. But basically, they're making this trimester argument all stemming from this right to privacy. And so if you try to square this trimester argument with the right to privacy, they sort of are trying to balance it, but it's ham-fisted. It's like, okay, you have a right to privacy. So in the first trimester, if you want to abort the pregnancy, that's your private right. But at a certain point, or even, you know, there's even that gray area of the second trimester, because states can, liberal states at this point could say, go ahead, abort it second trimester. More conservative states would say, you know, no, you have to have like a valid reason for the second trimester abortion. Mm-hmm. So they had some play there, and you saw different states having different laws between Roe being decided and then Casey being decided based on this trimester argument.
Okay, so what is the next case then, the Casey?
The next step? Okay, so the next step is Planned Parenthood of Pennsylvania versus Robert Casey, who was at the time the governor of Pennsylvania. And what happened is, this is in the late 80s, Pennsylvania changed their abortion law. They had, like a lot of states, had laws on the books that dictated when you can and cannot get an abortion. So they put in some provisions to try to make abortions more rare. These are like, you know how liberals like to talk about common sense gun control? This was like common sense abortion control. So there was a few provisions in the law. One was that a woman had to wait 24 hours before getting an abortion. So it's almost like California had, I don't know if they still have it on the books, but it was called a cooling off law, where you go in, if you want to buy a gun, you go buy a gun, do your background check, fill out your paperwork. If they approve you, they say, okay, you can come back and get your gun in 72 hours. And the idea was that if you wanted to kill somebody right now because you were super mad at them and you didn't have a gun and you were going to buy a gun with the intent to kill somebody like right now, you had to wait a few days, right? So this is a similar idea, but with abortion, that you go in, you talk to a doctor and you make your appointment, and then you have to come back in 24 hours. The other thing, there's a few things. Another one was that if you were a minor, you had to get parental consent to have an abortion. If you are a married woman, there was something about informing your husband. I don't know if your husband had to sign off on it or if you just had to inform him, something along those lines. And then, yeah, so those, I think those were the three big things, like the cooling off period, informing parents if you're a minor, informing your husband if you're married. And then what they said in this decision challenging this kind of common sense abortion control law was that they were going to essentially overrule or modify the trimester approach to Roe versus Wade, and instead do something what they call like an undue burden on a woman seeking an abortion. And if a state passes a law that creates an undue burden, it will be struck down. So in this particular case, they struck down husband notification requirement, which I thought is odd because that seems to be like the not very burdensome, but they said, okay, you can have the informed consent in 24-hour waiting, and you can have a parent sign off on the abortion if they're a minor, but you don't have to notify your husband. And then going forward, what happened is the cases after Casey, there's a bunch of them, and they're not really that interesting. I'll just sum them up and say that because of the substantial obstacle or undue burden test that that they gave in Casey, what would happen is states would do something. There was a southern state that made a law that said abortion clinics have to be partnered with a hospital, so that way if something is botched during the abortion procedure, that they have like an emergency ambulance on standby to take the person to the hospital. So what happened after this is that several abortion clinics were unable to get hospital partnership because a lot of the hospitals in this state and where certain abortion clinics were like Catholic or Methodist affiliated hospitals who would not partner with abortion clinics. So then they all closed up. And what happened is a woman challenged the law and said, hey, if I want an abortion, I can't get one unless I travel 400 miles or whatever it is to the next abortion clinic because all the ones in my area closed up. This is an undue burden on my ability to get an abortion. Therefore, it violates Casey versus Planned Parenthood. Therefore, it's unconstitutional. And then, you know, the Supreme Court would look at it and say, yeah, this is an undue burden. You're not allowed to have this law that makes abortion clinics be tied to a hospital. And there's been several things. There's been other waiting periods. There's been other type of consents. There's been a limitation. I think one state did like a limitation on how many abortion clinics you could have per number of people. And there's been all these kind of, they're pettier cases. Not petty in, you know, the gravity of the situation, but in that they're sort of arguing the minutiae of Casey, of what is and is not an undue burden. So every time a state, up until I think now, if this changes, every time a state enacts a law restricting abortion, it would now get challenged under Casey, not Roe anymore. So Roe v. Wade is kind of by the wayside, and this Casey is now the main standard we're looking
Interesting. At. Yep. Well, the idea of an undue burden, again, it seems very question begging to me, because the whole concept of what a due or undue burden would be would seem to depend on how serious you think abortion is. And that really depends on whether or not you think you're killing another human being, right?
Yeah.
And that's the issue that really needs to be decided. And the people who say, well, if you're killing another human being, shouldn't you take this really, really seriously? Shouldn't the father know? I mean, if it's that serious, shouldn't the father know? It's astonishing that the idea that informing a man that his child is about to be aborted is considered an undue burden.
Right. Yeah. It's really wild that it is.
Well, I mean, it would certainly perhaps discourage some women from getting abortions, and that's probably why it's being treated as an undue burden.
Yeah, it gives somebody the opportunity, probably the person in the best position to argue, like if the father doesn't want the child to be aborted, who else is in a better position to argue it than the father? You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's kind of the one person that you would think of everybody in the world that could step in and be like, hey, you know, let's not get an abortion, and the woman would listen. And that's probably why you probably get in that decision. I always thought there was a decent amount of sort of just man hate and this idea of I'm a fierce, strong, independent woman and don't need no man to tell me what to do. And like they didn't want that in there because they didn't want a man coming in and telling a woman what to do with her body. There's sort of some of those undertones.
Yeah, exactly. Somehow the man was involved in impregnating the woman, but yeah, he can't be involved in talking over the decision to kill his own offspring.
Yeah. So that's sort of the legal regime going from this initial idea of a right to privacy that they sort of is found in the shadows of the Bill of Rights all the way up until really now, with the exception of what happens with this opinion that got leaked.
Yeah. So what is the argument of the opinion, and how does it strike at Roe, and does it also strike at Casey?
There are a lot of interesting arguments in here, in this leaked opinion. One is sort of an attack on the Latin term stare decisis, of letting the decision stand. And you see a lot of times in Supreme Court holdings that it was the case in where they appeal to like legal and American history. And some of the stuff early on you're seeing in this is they're saying, hey, there was no real legal or American kind of history to appeal to when everyone's saying we have to let these decisions stand, we have to let them stand. Alito's coming in and saying, well, where are you even getting that from? You know, we don't see anything in kind of the Constitution or early American laws about this. It's sort of a fundamental right. And they're attacking the idea of abortion as a fundamental right. And also attacking the kind of gap in logic between, okay, you have a right to privacy, therefore you have a right to abort an unborn human. Like, well, how is you know, what's the connection there? So that's a lot of what they're reasoning. There's various other things in there. One is about, you know, suppression of the population, which is, that sounds kind of ridiculous in a way, but there's a reason for that. And there was a, let me see if I can pull it up real quick. Basically, there was this woman who was a Jewish journalist who interviewed Ruth Bader Ginsburg at some point many years ago. And her name was Emily Bazelon. So in 2009, in the New York Times, there was a interview and they were talking about Roe versus Wade. And Ginsburg commented in quotes, "Frankly, I had thought that at the time Roe was decided, there was a concern about population growth, and particularly growth in populations that we don't want to have too many of, so that Roe is going to be set up for a Medicaid funding and abortion." So this was later heavily criticized, and the people who are more pro-life were essentially attacking Ginsburg as a racist and a eugenicist, which, you know, I thought is odd, but I suppose plausible. And so I think part of the reason that you see in this leaked Alito opinion that he mentions that is almost kind of a stab at this old New York Times interview with Ruth Bader Ginsburg of saying, hey, when we were passing the initial decision in 1973, there was concerns of overpopulation in the 70s. And I don't know that it was politically popular about suppressing certain populations, but that's a topic that has come up on Countercurrents. You and Goad and Hampton all wrote about this, you know, the idea, which I think is correct, that if you have, well, maybe it's probably correct that if you make it harder to get abortions, you'll have like a lot more unwanted pregnancies, especially from the Black and Hispanic communities who do participate in abortion quite often. So there, you see that kind of argument. But the general crux of it, from what I can tell from reading through the unpublished leaked opinion, is that they're saying this just was never a good legal decision. It was always kind of flaky, and it's flaky now, and it's something that we should maybe turn over to the voters because of the level of outrage and, frankly, screeching by both sides. And I don't mean screeching as in a disparaging way, because it is a serious issue, but basically both sides have been yelling at each other for 50 years about this, and the Republicans and conservatives and pro-life people want this returned back to the state so they can vote on it or challenge a legislature. And this is a critique that Scalia often had in his dissent in Obergefell. He was saying this huge issue like gay marriage, and us who are 9 justices from elite universities and everybody's from the East Coast except for one Californian, you know, we are taking the decision away from 300 million people and deciding it for them on an issue people would probably rather vote on. And you see those kind of tones too in this leaked opinion of something. Hey, you know, it was 50 years ago, 9 unelected officials, people appointed for life, made the decision. And clearly everybody in society wants it to be returned to their state legislatures. Whether that's true or not, that's an argument they make, and I think is convincing. And he's saying, you know, let's vote on it. Let people call their reps and complain about it. Let people deal with it at that level. And that's a big theme in the opinion as well.
Well, if Roe versus Wade is overturned, what that implies is simply that a nationwide federal legalization of abortion no longer exists. It doesn't mean that abortion will be illegal in all 50 states. It means that will be decided by the legislatures of various states. Or if the National Congress, if Congress in Washington, D.C. wants to amend the Constitution one way or another, then it could be handled that way. But in any way, it's going to be in the hands of legislators, and ultimately, we hope, the hands of voters, rather than the hands of Supreme Court justices 50 years ago, all of whom are dead, none of whom were elected, and none of whom were there as legislators in the first place.
Right. That's a kind of a good lead-in if you want to talk about kind of what happens if they do overrule it too. There's been, I follow on a couple accounts, social media accounts, I follow a bunch of like very far left people, and they are mostly avowed communist of one flavor or another, and they critique liberals heavily, and sometimes they have interesting and good critiques of them. One thing I noticed, there's a similarity between these far left people and the far right, in that the far left people will say things like, even when the GOP is not in power, they're still getting what they want, and they get everything they want, and we get nothing we want. And that mirrors how we feel in a lot of ways. And then it seems like maybe only the centrists are happy. But one of their big critiques is that a lot of liberal politicians have for years, including recently, run on the idea of codifying the decision of Casey into like federal law, passing a law, some act that says, you know, this isn't just the decision, this is our law. Kind of how, you know, you saw with Shelley versus Kramer, which was a housing covenant act, got 20 years later codified into the Fair Housing Act, right? So it's not like unheard of that a Supreme Court decision gets later codified into federal law. That's a thing that happens, and they wanted that to happen. And they are saying, even when they controlled Congress, controlled the president, had, you know, everything going their way, even to the point where people, I believe Biden too, campaigning on things like codifying Casey and Roe and federal law, they failed to do it, and now left this open to be overturned by what they believe are like Trump's renegade far-right fascist judges, which I don't believe with that characterization, but they still have a point that, like, hey, these people told us we voted for them because they were going to codify it, and then they didn't, and they left this kind of open to get overturned, and that's what's happening. So that's interesting. It is totally going to be up in the hands of legislatures. There's some states that are going to, I think, had laws in the books that in case it gets overturned, they kind of spring into life, that will restrict abortion to some degree. So I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if there's going to be less abortions, more abortions. It might cause, we could talk probably the rest of the time on different consequences and which way they could go in theory. One friend of mine had one angle I haven't thought of, and he said that he lives in a more conservative state, but there's a ton of California transplants moving there. And of course people hate it, because I'm dealing with the same thing where I live. As soon as people move from out of state or the inner city out further to a more conservative area, the very first thing they do is start putting up Black Lives Matter signs and gay pride stuff everywhere, and talking about how there's not enough restaurants and diversity. It's like you literally fleed one place because you're talking about how bad the crime and taxes were. And then as soon as you set up in the next place, you want to recreate it. You know, you're like a plague. But he was saying that if, you know, there's this stark divide between states on their level of abortion legality or illegality, that it might prevent liberal transplants from going places that are more conservative. They might think, oh, I'm not going to so-and-so state, I won't be able to get an abortion. And that's an interesting downstream effect that might be good for us. So, you know, I think,
in the short term, it's increasing political polarization, which I think is a good thing for us. Anything that causes polarization, gridlock, et cetera, in the current system is good for dissidents like us who don't really want this system to work very well. We want something better. And then in the long run, yes, if what you see is a strong distinction between blue state abortion laws and red state abortion laws, that will, I think, cause people to self-sort, to move to blue states or red states, that depending on their opinions on these matters. And that's, I think, a prelude to national divorce on some level or another, because we think that this current system will probably break down under the stresses that it's under currently. And wouldn't it be nice if the different jurisdictions that are suddenly free of Washington's control are fairly homogeneous and pre-sorted? It would be nice and neat if that were to happen, I think.
Yeah, I think that is an interesting argument for the potential good things. I am, it's so divisive, so I don't want to belabor it, but I'm kind of the opinion of... there's a lot of moral arguments going around about abortion being evil and whatnot, and it's killing and all that. And maybe, But I just am of the opinion that, like, it's not my job to stop every non-white or liberal from doing every little evil thing they're going to do. And, you know, I had a person, I said something like that, and they said, well, you should care because they're still in your country, like you're talking about Blacks and Hispanics and stuff. And I said, yeah, but they're not really part of my people or nation. It's like if, you know, we had a divorce and there was, let's just say hypothetically, there was like a Black state or a Black country that was right next to us. And it's like they want to have abortion, right? They want to have abortion up to 30th term. You can pull them right out of third grade and abort them, right? Like, would we, would it be worth invading them to stop them to do it? I don't think so. You can't stop every little thing or even big thing that everybody does. And there's like a lot of tragic things that happen all over all the time, and not every single one is going to be ours to bear.
Right. My take on this in my recent article at Countercurrents is that I'm of two minds. I'm divided on this. I think from a philosophical point of view, you can make a very strong case against abortion. Life begins at conception. Life is valuable. We would have to have very, very good reasons not to bring a conceived child to term, therefore. Things like, you know, threatening the life of the mother. That's really the only one. Even these exceptions like rape and incest, that strikes me as punishing the wrong person, right? If a child is conceived in rape or conceived in incest, obviously somebody's done something wrong, but the child hasn't done anything wrong. So why abort it? Even in the case of deformed children and retarded children, you can say, well, they're not going to have very much quality of life, et cetera, or they'll be a burden on society. Yeah, maybe so. But, you know, the world is fairly big and fairly rich. We could even make a place for them if we really wanted to take a strong stance on the sanctity of innocent life. And I think that white nationalism, as I understand it, is completely consistent with the idea that everybody can have rights. It's just that not everybody fits equally well in the same political order. And therefore, those who don't fit in, well, they have the right to their own political orders. So you can have a notion of very robust human rights and still be a white nationalist, still be a separatist. It's a burden, right? It's a burden to grant that other people have rights, because what that does is it makes it wrong for you to rob them or rape them or kill them just because you find that convenient. And the liberal argument today in America is that the 63 million abortions that have taken place since 1973, that was worth it. It's worth killing 63 million people because it's convenient or it's a choice, et cetera. And I just don't think that that's a very high moral standard or very high moral ground to stand on. I do think that you can make a very strong case from a white nationalist standpoint of bearing the burden of recognizing that human beings have rights and you just can't murder people out of convenience. But on the other hand, the question is, well, abortion does seem to disproportionately affect our demographic rivals. We have bigger problems. I mean, that's my main argument. Abortion is a terrible thing. I would ban it in a white nationalist society. A healthy society would ban it. But this is a sick society. This is a multiracial society. This is a society where there's systematic, baked-in white genocide going on. And my question is therefore abortion that important a question to us? And there are two factors here that make me think, no, it's not that important to us if we're really concerned about white genocide. The first is that it disproportionately affects our demographic rivals. And second, even the whites who engage in this practice are often whites of questionable value or little value or our enemies. And the question that I have is, do we have an obligation to prevent our enemies from making a serious mistake? Do we have an obligation to spend our scarce political capital and time persuading our enemies to stop killing millions of their own offspring, which is actually making our job and our children's futures a little more easy to secure. So I think it would be wrong of me. I don't advocate for abortion, but by the same token, I don't see that I have a strong moral obligation to interrupt my enemies when they're making a serious mistake, a mistake that works to the benefit of my people. Because even though I believe in universal human rights, et cetera, I also believe it's perfectly natural, normal, and right to have a preference for your own kind against others, and especially a preference for your own kind against others when those others are your demographic rivals and you are locked in a demographic contest. And currently, we're losing. We're losing badly. And we're on a steady path to just losing it all.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of of a similar mind. You know, I've gone back and forth on the abortion thing. Like I personally wouldn't have an abortion. Like, if I got somebody pregnant, I would not want them to abort our kid. At the same time, I think, you know, similar thing about the demographic situation. Some people make the argument that, you know, because whites are being aborted, we should end it totally, even if it means much more blacks, because you're saving some white people. And I think there's merit. I think there's merit to a lot of the pro-life arguments. And I think that one is interesting in a way, because they're saying, like, it doesn't matter if there's a bunch more blacks being born, because your job is to help the white people. And even if it was a, you know, 1,000-to-1 ratio, you shouldn't sacrifice one white baby for 1,000 blacks from being born, kind of idea. And I get that. And I think that's a very fair position to take as well. I think there are a lot of downstream effects people don't consider. Sometimes you see the liberals bringing it up, and one of the downstream effects is, like, what happens to millions, potentially millions of unwanted babies. There was something about that, about adoption, brought up in the leaked opinion about how, you know, there's essentially a shortage of babies for adoption, which is a weird way to put it. Talked about them like they're widgets, like there was, you know, we have a real deficit of the supply of babies being adopted right now. And so, you know, there's kind of those arguments. You know, I was mentioning to you earlier, I think, you know, and this is just a point of consideration, not an argument to sway it one way or another, but every few months, it seems like I see an article about some black teenager giving birth in a bathroom and throwing the baby in the dumpster. And I, you know, I wonder how much more that's going to happen. And it's one of the downstream consequences, I think, people will find. I was reading an article earlier about, I was actually in a book called Constitutional Law Stories, and it's about what the patchwork of laws were like before 1973, and about women. A lot of them were in Texas because they could go to Mexico and get an abortion, and health considerations of all of that. All the botched abortions, like, that happened when it was illegal, that then women had to be cared for in different ways. The effects of all, you know, millions of potentially unwanted children, you know, it seems those all seem to be sort of lost on people who are pro-life. They just seem to think it's still worth it.
As a person who is generally pro-life, okay, I'm pro-life in the sense that I advocate ending abortion. I'm not pro-life in the sense that I want to use my social capital to actually bring it to an end, for the simple reason that I believe that we've got bigger things to do, and that it's, strategically speaking, counterproductive for whites to spend our social capital on that, since there are very few white people who are awake to the problem of white genocide, to put it bluntly. However, yeah. You know, the arguments like, well, what about women who might suffer from back alley abortions? Those never have cut any ice with me, because that's saying, well, you know, why should we have laws against armed robbery? Why shouldn't we get rid of the law against armed robbery? Think of the armed robbers who die committing armed robberies. Shouldn't we be concerned about legalizing armed robbery so that these people don't die accidentally while they're trying to rob you? It just seems crazy to me. The last person I'm really concerned with is the safety of the person who's committing a crime. And I do think that, you know, if abortion is a crime, it's not just the abortionist who's committing the crime. The greater crime is the woman or the woman's husband or boyfriend or whatever, who's the person pushing for the abortion, who's paying for the crime, right? And it just never struck me as particularly powerful argument that, well, we can't ban abortion because some of these people might suffer terribly while they're trying to kill their offspring. It's like, so what? I'm on the side of the offspring, not the criminals. And I do think that many pro-lifers will not just openly admit that if abortion is a crime, then there should be punishment for the women who actually get abortions. You shouldn't just punish the abortion doctors. You should punish the people who are actually paying for the procedures.
Yeah, I don't think it really carried too much weight with me either, but on the same, maybe in a similar sense, I guess, you know, I'm sort of kind of with you on it where I have views on it, but I think that it's just not the most significant issue to me or us. And I think a lot of that also stems from because there's like so much support on both sides for it. And I think that's really something that sort of keeps me from being like really adamant either way, where like there's a ton of very well-funded, well-staffed organizations kind of fighting on this both sides. And it's like, you know, it's in one of the articles published. It's like, what's, you know, one racist have to say about it, I guess.
Yeah. I feel like we're sort of a lonely group of people on the margins, and that both the pro-life and the pro-choice mainstream will point at us and shriek with horror at our positions, that you know, they can at least be united on one thing, and that's condemning us for having all the wrong reasons. Even if we take the right side in their opinion, we do so for always the wrong reasons.
Right. Yeah. I find myself in that position like all the time of agreeing with like people for the wrong reasons. So there's a couple people. I don't know if you want to get the comments. I just was reading through.
Yeah, let's talk.
But like one I saw was he said we have big brain, cynical, jaded, detached takes. And that, I mean, I get that's a criticism of us, but it's not. I am a bit jaded and detached from this issue because it's, like I said, it's an issue, you know, personally, I wouldn't abort my own kid, but on the same, you know, what I'm saying is I don't feel the need to go stop every liberal or black who does. Like they do a lot of terrible things. And it's, in a way, it reminds me of this study I saw, and it was showing blacks overwhelmingly support gun control, but this went a little bit further and was trying to figure out why. And the reason that blacks, according to this study, support gun control is because so many blacks have friends and family that were killed mostly by other blacks with a gun. And so their reasoning is that if it's harder to get guns, you know, they would have less people killed by guns. And that's like not a really compelling argument to me, because I don't think we should sacrifice access to firearms because black people kill each other with them. And I guess it's kind of the same thing here. Like, I don't feel the need to step in to inner city gang violence in Chicago because I don't care. And as terrible as that is, I am cynical and jaded towards a lot of issues, particularly when it's an out-group population, like doing terrible things to each other. Like, I don't disagree that it's terrible for people to abort their kids and that there is a life there and you're snuffing it out. Like, that's the correct view, objectively, I believe. I just don't think it's my place to spend my time in jumping into that when there's other concerns I have, I guess.
So our friend Gadius Maximus writes in, with a $10 donation. Thank you very much. You do so much. I appreciate it. And he writes, Lakeisha isn't going to stop taking the lazy way out of her responsibilities just because her state bans abortion. Magic Americans aren't really known for their respect for the law. Yeah, this is true. They will find a way, but how to put it? They don't respect the law, but by the same token, they're not really, really good at breaking it either in terms of any kind of long-term planning, right? So if Lakeisha can't get an abortion for free at Planned Parenthood in her neighborhood, she might find it an insuperable burden to go 20 miles away across state lines, because that's just the kind of thing that Lakeisha's find to be insuperable burdens, right? Undue burdens. It's an undue burden to ask her to, you know, learn how to get to a place in a different state. And so she might end up not aborting, not because she's law abiding in any deep moral sense, but just because if laws put burdens and barriers in the way of some people who are kind of passive, then they're just not going to do anything about it. It is interesting that, and this was something shared by American Krogan, the map of states that have the largest Black populations pretty much coincides with the map of states that will probably make abortion harder to get a hold of post Roe v. Wade. A lot of these are Bible Belt states in the South where people have strong religious convictions about the sanctity of life. And that means that there probably will be more Trayvons and Lakeishas and George Floyds to deal with. And 15, 16 years later, they'll have their own children. By the time they're in their 30s, they'll be grandparents. And this is in a democracy, right, where they're not only enfranchised, but they're objectively privileged. This is just going to make it harder for whites to regain control of our society and our future. So I can't look upon this with rejoicing. Like I said, I would not institute abortion because I don't think it's right to just kill millions of our rivals because it's convenient. I do think they have rights. But by the same token, I'm not really eager to see this particular mass murder for convenience go away right now. So I just can't be too excited about it. I just can't, because it really does disadvantage whites. It disadvantages us demographically, and I think there are probably some eugenic effects that it has too. If the kind of people who are willing and, you know, the kind of people who are cold-hearted enough to kill their own offspring, the traits of those people are probably largely heritable. You know, we know that genetics play a huge role in character traits, personality traits, and the kind of selfishness and coldness of somebody who could kill their own offspring like that, that's a genetic trait. And these people are removing themselves from the future. And that makes the world a better place in some way. So I can't be too enthusiastic about seeing this end, but by the same token, it's not something that I would put in place just because it has demographically positive or eugenically positive effects. Because, like I said, it may be good enough for liberals to kill people by the millions for convenience, but we have a higher moral standard. So anyway, that's my take on it. And I know it doesn't satisfy a lot of people, but that's where I am on the prospect of seeing Roe v. Wade overturned. I would like to see some good possible benefits from this, because I do think it's going to happen. And one of the benefits is increased polarization, including polarization and homogenization between red and blue states, with states with abortion laws and, you know, abortion restrictions and liberal abortion laws. I think that that could be a positive thing in the future. Another thing I mentioned in my article is that I do think that the pro-life movement in many ways should be emulated by white nationalists. We believe that there's a quiet genocide taking place against white people. And a lot of people just find that silly. They just poo-poo that. People in our own camp poo-poo that idea. They think that, no, that can't be real. That doesn't coincide with my experience. Consumer electronics are cheap and you know, the bars and restaurants are full of happy, smiling people. How can there be a genocide going on in the society? Well, the pro-life movement has convinced a lot of people that there can be a silent genocide going on, a hidden genocide going on in an ostensibly normal society. And it's happened to the tune of 63 million people over the last half century in what appears to be a normal, decent society full of lovey-dovey people. In fact, it's been instituted by the most lovey-dovey amongst us, the liberals. And so if they can do that, we can sell the white genocide idea. We can wake people up to white genocide. We have to use some of their own techniques. I think we should imitate them. And I also admire just how disciplined they are, because they are a movement with an enormous amount of moral fervor and urgency. And yet they have been pretty successful in tamping down on the kind of people who think, well, we just need to start bombing abortion clinics then. If it's that serious, we need to start doing that. They realize, no, that doesn't help. And it just basically adds crime to crime. You know, it's a crime in itself. And also because it delays the day when the pro-life movement will win, it actually causes more abortions. And I think the same kind of argument applies to the people in our cause who, you know, go on shooting sprees and things like that. These people are contributing to white genocide. They're making it harder for us to bring it to an end. So anyway, those are some thoughts on this. Rich, can you tell folks how to follow your work?
Yeah, the best place is probably Twitter. I post updates on like new articles and things there. It's twitter.com/heywildrich. And that's probably the best place. Or if just on Countercurrents, there's a Richard Haupt tab somewhere on there. And a bunch of my old articles are all there, and, you know, have some more in the works. So, you know, check in Countercurrents under my name is a good place too.
There's a question here from Lepro8.
About the Depp Rich, case?
Yeah, have you been following the Depp case at all? That is an interesting case.
Just kind of barely. It's interesting because, well, I think, yeah, there's like some bigger societal issues there. Like Amber Heard said defamatory things about Johnny Depp that got him fired from his role in Pirates of the Caribbean and lost him like $100 million or something or more in salaries from being fired. And I think everybody but like Dior dropped him, or a significant amount of people except for Dior. He had an advertisement for their a cologne. So this is a case, a rare case where you get like a true defamation lawsuit, because defamation is almost non-existent. Like you hear the phrase defamation and libel and slander a lot, but in reality, and I think accurately, because courts are very reluctant to punish anybody for speaking because of the First Amendment and how it looks and how it has like a chilling effect on speech, especially for public characters. They want people to be able to say pretty much whatever they want. And again, I agree with that. So you don't see a lot of like good defamation cases pop up as a result. But this is a really interesting one because it has potentially untrue statements if she did lie about him abusing her, and it had real damages. So for defamation to work, you either have to have real damages or it has to be defamation per se. Like you say somebody is a criminal, like specifically criminal. Like if you say, you know, John Smith stole my car and he didn't steal your car, he can sue you for that, you know, because damages are presumed that if you are telling people he's a car thief or a rapist or something like that, that it's obviously presumed. And in this case, I don't know exactly what kind of abuse she alleged, but it could be criminal, which if it is criminal and she's alleging he's did crimes, it could be defamation per se, which is one of those specific cases. But even in general defamation, because he has actual real life money damages he can show, he's able to bring the suit. He can actually, you know, bring in the court and say, look, Disney fired me from Pirates of the Caribbean because of what she said. That's why they fired me. And I lost $100 million. Pay up. So just for that, it's really interesting. And then, of course, it's a televised, you know, TV in the courtroom, and they're both actors, and he seems to be a funny guy. And there's just been a tremendous number of great moments. Like, a lot of people don't know, Johnny Depp's actually a really fantastic guitar player. And there was like some little back and forth in the courtroom about Amber Heard saying, you know, Johnny Depp just wanted to play guitar with his friends who were like, I mean, I think he's done bits with like Eric Clapton and some of the greats. And it's just hilarious that you have this woman who's like, you know, I was so bored seeing my fantastically rich and famous husband playing guitar with his fantastically rich and famous friends. Gosh, I wish I was at home on Twitter. Like, it's just such a ridiculous thing that she's saying. And so it's been entertaining for that and for the just for defamation in general. If you're interested or know anything about defamation, you know how it's rare to get a good case like this. And I think it's good. I've seen some kind of cultural thing, memes going around about pushing back on the toxic masculinity meme, where it's talking about toxic womanhood, and they're using Amber Heard as an example of this. And I think that's good too, because this really pushes back on sort of, you know, believe all women hashtag, and the idea that, you know, the man, you know, it might change things a little bit culturally, because Disney's gonna, they, if it comes out and Johnny Depp wins, Disney's gonna have lost out a lot of money. The other advertisers who booted him are gonna have egg on their face and have lost money severing that partnership. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good thing too.
The stuff that I've heard, and it's very little, I haven't followed it very carefully at all, is the net impression that I've gotten from this is how weird these Hollywood people are. How weird and twisted they are. She's utterly weird and twisted. It's astonishing how much men will put up with from weird and twisted women. The reaction to having the tip of his finger chopped off by her in one of her rages is really weird. He started writing with his own blood. I just find all of these people, they might as well be from Mars. There's something strange about them. I like Johnny Depp as an actor. He's been doing great, interesting roles for years. I do respect him as an actor, but damn, these people are strange. So I think it's actually very, very useful culturally, just for people to watch in horror at the weirdness of these people. Also, I do think that this is very damaging, exactly, to the believe all women stuff. And, you know, there's a huge amount of spousal abuse of men by women. It's politically incorrect to talk about it. It's a hidden problem. And now it's being aired out in the form of this trial. He never abused her, but there's ample evidence that she was physically abusing him. So I think this is raising awareness of a lot of things that's really quite healthy, actually. So I'm kind of happy about it.
I'm going to push back just slightly on your comment, Greg, about how weird the Hollywood types are. Man, if you ever had the, you know, dated a young woman in her 20s, they're kind of all like that.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm just thinking specifically how weird Depp is.
Oh, yeah. He might be a little weird, but like, man, Amber Heard reminds me too much of a couple ex-girlfriends.
Yeah. Okay. The crazy ex-girlfriend. Yeah. She's really the crazy ex-girlfriend.
She is.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we should wrap up. Rich, thank you so much for this.
Thanks for having me.
It's been really helpful, and I appreciate it. I know the audience out there appreciates it, and this is going to be listened to many times when it goes up on Countercurrents this coming week. So thank you very much, and let's definitely do have you back soon
on we'll another episode. All right. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Even I really appreciate all the comments, even from people like Comey, who said I'm a cynic. He's a little bit right. Even the, you know, negative comments, I appreciate him because it gives me something to think about, and I think he has some points. So thanks, everybody, for watching, commenting, both good and bad, and we'll see you all next time.
Thank you.